What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Frank Burris. Frank is a writer based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. His stories have appeared in the Best American Travel Writing, and he's the author of the new book, Geography of Madness, Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for the Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. So welcome to Madness Radio, Frank Burris.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Frank, that's really quite a title of your new book. Tell us about this book and how it might not be quite what people would expect in the travel literature genre.
Yes, it's definitely not what the usual travel genre fare. And the title is shocking, but it's mainly meant to get people to pick it up. On the inside, it's actually really a serious quest for, you know, the answers to questions that I had about culture and cultural syndromes and how our beliefs kind of shape our world and shape ourselves.
So when you say cultural syndromes, you're talking about the diseases that some cultures have where they believe that someone's genitals are being stolen from them or they're disappearing or shrinking. And that's actually something that does exist in Africa and in China.
Right. Yes, it does. It does. And I first read about this. It was on a couple of stories on the BBC around 2001, where in Nigeria and Benin, people would think that their genitals were being stolen magically by somebody around them, and then they would look around and see somebody who they thought might have done it and blame them, and then a lot of times that person would be sort of lynched by a mob. And so I just thought this was a fascinating and, you know, tragic, obviously, but fascinating phenomenon. You know, we don't obviously have anything like it in the U.S. But I wanted to write about it, and I didn't know exactly why. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to say about it, but I was interested in not writing about it in a way that, like, oh, this is ridiculous and these silly people have these superstitions, but more like I was more interested in what it would be like to live in a world like that where that was possible. And that's why I went to Nigeria to try to find some people who had had this experience and just to see what it was like.
Well, that's what I think is so unique and valuable about the book, is that you take what is probably the most bizarre, different experience that one could imagine, witchcraft or something that's a magical attack that would seem completely outside of our realm of understanding. And then instead of looking at it from the outside and outlining it as being bizarre and strange and a weird superstition that reflects a primitive culture, your effort is really to get inside of that understanding and to be understanding the culture on its own terms, and so that it makes sense and says a lot about culture in general. Is that right?
Yes, and it's probably because of my background, having lived in a couple different cultures and got moved sort of in and out of them, I knew that things look much differently from the inside than from the outside, and everybody's culture kind of seems weird. And the cultural syndromes are illnesses that kind of grow out of the way people see the world in a way. And so I knew that that was a good sort of entree into these questions. If you say something's a cultural syndrome or culture bound or anything like that, or it's partly caused by the culture, that only really means something if you can define what culture is and how it works. And so I spent a few years trying to sort of explore that idea. And
you write that even what culture is not clear. Then you came up with a workable definition yourself?
One way to think about it is culture is like this network of stories that we're part of, or that we feel like we're part of, and that we share with other people. And by stories, I don't mean just what you usually think of by stories. I mean causal chains of events. So the way you think things happen in the world, from the Big Bang or the story of the Bible or however you think the world came into being, to how your group that you're part of or the groups that you're part of kind of came into existence and what that means and what are the forces holding those stories together, you know. And so we're all part of these kind of various storylines that we feel are real or important. And to the extent that you share those with our people, you're part of the same culture.
It's significant for me to think about this because so much of what we talk about on Madness Radio is the experience of psychosis, which is really, in a sense, when one person drops out of the shared cultural story of the people around them and is inhabiting a different culture, in a sense. They have a whole different way of following what the chain of events, the chain of causality, and it seems to go against what's known to be real or what's known to be true or what's known to be possible. People say and do things and have beliefs that are very, very strange or magical or nonsensical from a certain perspective, but from that person's perspective, they do make sense and they do have a certain logic. And I think that's part of the interest that I had in the book, is that so much of what working with people who are having psychotic experiences seems to be is really being able to cross from one cultural framework to another and to be able to empathize and get inside of a different lived experience, a different lived reality where that person's culture makes sense. It just comes from a different logic. It comes from a set of different stories that the other culture might have. And that's what you've done in this book. So I found that that was a really interesting parallel. And also the whole question that I think that one culture always sort of compares to another culture and says, well, my culture is based on reality and yours isn't. That's not real. That's not possible. What you're saying is true isn't true. The biblical stories aren't true. Or the other perspective, the Big Bang story isn't true, or magic is not true. Magic is not possible. The idea of voodoo death or penis theft is not possible because it's just not based in reality. It's not based in truth. And so the question of what is reality becomes central to that disconnect of different conflicts coming in or one culture trying to impose itself on another culture. Tell us a little bit about what some of these culture-bound syndromes are and what that means, what it means when we say culture-bound syndrome, and what some examples are and some of the things that you learned in your travels.
The culture-bound syndromes, there's a sort of a long list of them. The term that people use now is called more cultural syndromes, because a lot of people objected to the idea of being bound to something like culture because it's a weird word. And what does that mean? It's more of a fixed idea of culture. And whereas the general understanding of culture has become more fluid and more of a dynamic kind of thing that you can't necessarily be bound to, sort of. So most people who research this now say cultural syndromes.
Is it a term from the DSM and from medicine?
Yeah, and they've always been controversial because in past editions of the DSM, they've been sort of at the back in an appendix a lot of people objected to because it's like a sort of exotic museum of weird mental illnesses that aren't just sort of the implication is that they're not real mental illnesses because that we don't have them, whereas the ones in the main text are the real ones that are purely biological and not based on our culture at all. And so that list has historically included things like amok, which is something in Malaysia, and it's in a lot of countries, but where somebody will go into this disassociated homicidal rage and kill a bunch of people or injure a bunch of people and then sort of not remember it afterwards. Also in the Malay Peninsula kind of area, there's something called Lata, which is a startle matching syndrome where if somebody's like a hyper startler, they'll be surprised and then they kind of have to imitate the person who surprised them. They sort of will imitate or they'll say certain words or they'll say, there's a lot of different sort of permutations of it. Another one is called Kyal attacks, which they have in Cambodia, which is wind attacks. It's related to the biology of anxiety, but the way it plays out is different in Cambodia. And Kyal is like a wind that supposedly flows in your body alongside your blood. And if that becomes blocked or flows differently, then you can get all kinds of problems. There's Dhat syndrome, DHAT, which is in India and parts like that. Like people worry they're losing too much energy because of semen loss. And so for people in those cultures, if you have certain beliefs about what the meaning of semen and what the power of it is. And so those are some of the things that historically have been considered cultural syndromes.
And there's also Koro, is that?
Koro is called, or genital retraction syndrome, which is in parts of West Africa, maybe Central Africa, and then also in China, Southern China, Singapore, had been in Singapore, Hong Kong, and the sort of major features of it are pretty similar, but the belief in what is causing it is completely different. In West Africa, it'll be magic or, you know, something like that. And in China, in Chinese cosmology and medicine, there's this idea of balancing forces. And one of the forces is like the male and female, hot and cold. And so there can be like, it can be partly caused by like worry about losing too much yang or heat, hot element. And then in some parts of far southern China and in Hainan Island, it can also be considered a ghost that is coming around looking, collecting yang to go over into the next world or something, some version of that story. Voodoo death is something that was first written about in the West by Walter Cannon, who's a doctor who came up with the fight or flight mechanism. And he wrote a paper called Voodoo Death about this. And he had some theories about how it worked. And what it is when a person is cursed and they believe that they're going to die, they will sometimes actually die at the time when they said we're supposed to. And so that happens rarely, but it does happen. There's cases of it happening that you can document. And there's also for other versions of it that happen that are not quite as spectacular, but you can see it in the data. There's a guy named David Phillips who's found that more Japanese and Chinese people die on the 4th, which is of the month, which is considered unlucky, than on other days.
So people would be cursed and then told that they're going to die on a specific date, and then they would in fact die.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's related also to bone pointing, where someone will attack somebody by pointing a bone at them or cast a magical spell at them, and the person will become sick and die?
Yeah, that's definitely similar, if not the same. And that's in the Aboriginal cultures in Australia. There's cases of that where they break some taboo and a shaman or a medicine person points a bone at them and they are essentially excluded from society, and like all their family and everybody starts acting like they don't exist, and they'll just sort of waste away and die. It's not quite as sudden as some of the other cases, but it's like it's the social death followed by actual death. In China, I met a guy whose brother had been part of this massive epidemic in the 80s when like something like as many as 5,000 people felt like their genitals were disappearing on the island of Hainan in southern China, village by village over the course of a year. It would like pass from village to village, and then when the people heard that it was in the next village, they felt like the ghost had sort of gone on to that village, believed to be caused by the fox ghost or a witch that was wandering around the island at night. But he told me that people said that it was because of like a worm that crawled in your mouth at night. And I had never heard that or seen it written anywhere. And it's like a totally different kind of cause than like a supernatural cause. And so it's more of a physical like agent than a supernatural agent. And so I thought that was really interesting. I don't know if that story has evolved since then or if that was around at the time or what the framework is there, because it's really hard to research these things. The village I was going to was they didn't actually speak, most of the people didn't actually speak Chinese, even though it was in China. They spoke a dialect of Thai that was mm-hmm. You know, we had to find an interpreter who spoke Chinese and Lingua Hua, the local language. And so it's a really complicated cultural landscape on that island, because there's like at least 10 different languages, some of them, you know, all spoken by like a million people. Some of them have not been studied that much. And so it's difficult reporting in places like that. But just to get the tip of the story, you have to go there.
So thousands of people from village to village were believing that they had experienced this theft of their genitals. And then what happened to them?
Some of them end up being fine. They usually go to the doctor and it doesn't recur. Some of them have recurrences and a few, are sort of traumatized. I mean, it depends partly on whether people believe it's a real thing but not dangerous, or if it's a real thing and it is dangerous, or if they start to believe that it's not a real thing or not to worry about, or if it's just a psychological thing. Depends on how the person sort of interprets it at the time and after the fact. And the Chinese government went in with an education program to try to calm people down and say this is not something you need to worry about, and that seemed to work for a while. There hasn't been a massive, massive epidemic like that since then, and that's probably for a lot of different reasons, just how much things have changed, and the education campaign, so to speak. This still does happen on Hainan. It happened a couple of years before I was there, and then it happened the year after I left in 2014. There was a small epidemic in a town called Ladong that was not reported anywhere. It's the only reason I know about it is because my interpreter was a student there, and one of her friends was from Ladong, and she heard about it from her family. But that was the only way I could know about it, this was that she wrote to me like a year later and was like, oh, my friend said this just happened in Ladong.
So hearing reports from Africa and from Asia about penis thieves and voodoo death and these kinds of things, I think the reaction that we have is like, well, these are primitive beliefs. These are people who are in cultures that are still pre-modern. They don't have modern science. They don't understand how the world really works. They don't understand that these are not real. These are just beliefs. And that we in the West, with our advanced technology and our advanced science, we don't have these syndromes because we're actually more based in reality and we have science. And your view is different. You took that in a different direction in your book. So tell us about how you started to look at culture and reality when you were studying these syndromes more deeply.
So yeah, that idea of some cultures being primitive and some cultures being civilized is like an old interpretation of culture as this thing that progresses towards some high point, and I did talk about that in the book. That was the kind of theory of this guy named E.B. Tyler, who developed this idea, and that idea is still with us, that, some cultures are just undeveloped. And my view is different, and through that lens, it seems like these people believe in things that are not real, and we believe in things that are real. And I think that's a real problem in all these issues and in all talking about all these illnesses. The idea that something is imaginary or not, or it's real, is based kind of in this dualism of mind and body, and the idea that the body is real, all the physical, empirical things are real, and the mental imaginary things are sort of not real. The first thing actually that people start to get upset about when you start to suggest that we have also cultural syndromes is that you're saying that our mental illnesses are not real, and that's not what I'm saying at all, or that it's made up or something. But I am saying that there's this kind of looping effect between our beliefs about something like that and our biology, and that the way we expect things to go and the way that we interpret the meaning of experiences and feelings affects kind of our experience of it, becomes part of the cause of these syndromes.
We have this idea that if it's in your belief system, that it's in your mind, then therefore it's somehow not as real or as truthful or as concrete or as physical as your body. And you're saying that actually that's what needs to be challenged itself, is that dichotomy between those two.
Yeah, I think so. And the idea that these syndromes are just purely biomechanical, it's not like a straight line from the physical to the mental. It is a feedback loop. For example, Amy Cuddy and her colleagues have done this work. You probably heard about how if you arrange your body into kind of more powerful positions, it increases your levels of testosterone. And if you move yourself into like a more submissive position, diminutive position, then levels of testosterone go down, and they can measure this. And so there's a looping effect there that that I think is important to take into consideration when we're talking about these things. You know, we're part of the this process.
So with that example, so testosterone is not something that your body just has, that you're saying that there's a study that actually if someone, you can actually change the levels of testosterone in your body by making a decision, having a belief that you want to do something to change the posture of your body. Is that what that study shows?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I'm saying. And there's a really good book called The Upside of Stress by Kelly McGonigal, who I believe is a psychologist at Stanford. And the sort of basic argument of that book is that, you know, for a long time we believed that stress is just this inherently bad thing that has all these destructive effects on us. And what she argues and has found is that it's really what you believe about stress affects your experience of it. So if you, for example, believe that stress is damaging and dangerous, then you, when you get in have a stressful situation or you have a lot of stress in your life, then you worry about it and you feel like it's, and your body has what's called a threat response, you know, which has a different biological profile than if you don't believe it's bad for you or dangerous, then you have what's called a challenge response. And those will result in different levels of cortisol, the hormone cortisol and the hormone DHEA, you know, which is beneficial, which you'll have more of with the challenge response and less of with the threat response. And, you know, in the short term, it's not really a big deal, but over a long period, that can make a big difference.
So what you're saying really strikes a chord, because one of the things that we talk about in the Hearing Voices movement and in people who are responding to strange, unusual, different, uncanny experiences like hearing voices, like having a strange belief or seeing synchronicities or meaningful coincidences in the world around them, one of the things that we talk about is that it's not the actual experience that is the issue. It's the relationship that you have with the experience. If you are hearing voices and then you have a threat response, if you're afraid of the voice that you're hearing and you withdraw from it and push it away and disengage from it, it can actually make the whole situation worse and make yourself feel out of control and then lead to a situation where you're not able to cope with or live with the voice. And what you're saying is very parallel, that with something like stress, which we could, like a voice, say, oh, it's a bad, hearing voices is bad, stress is bad, that actually, no, stress is connected with a relationship. So if someone has a stressful experience, then they have a relationship with that experience where they either treat it as a threat or they treat it as a challenge based on their belief. And then that creates a kind of a loop between the physical experience and the belief or the response, the relationship that the belief has with that experience, that then loops back in and then changes the physiology. So if the actual stress hormones themselves change, and then the experience of that stress is different for the person. So it sounds like that's what we're talking about, is challenging the mind-body duality and actually understanding that with any experience that we have, there's always this loop of this response and relationship to it, and it can mean very different things for different people based on what their belief is. And you're suggesting that this is actually really demonstrated by a lot of scientific studies that are now available to us.
And it complicates the sort of the mechanistic model that we usually have of the body and health and stuff. And you know, I assume you know Ethan Waters and his book Crazy Like Us. You know, he talks in there about this study that they did in schizophrenia around the world that nobody's really ever been able to explain why. You know, poorer countries like Colombia, Nigeria, India, they have levels of schizophrenia where, you know, 24% of the people will be seriously disabled, whereas in more industrialized countries like the U.S. and Denmark, Thailand, you have more like 40% seriously disabled. And the question, obviously, is people's interpretation of what that illness is, you know, making it more or less difficult to deal with it. And you also have to throw into that the understanding of all the people around you. What do they believe? If they believe something is damaging it, or, you know, it's really hard to to get away from what all the people around you believe is true.
So if the people around you are having a threat response to something, then that's going to loop back into your own experience of it. And this ties in directly to what we see in alternative approaches to responding to psychosis or things that get diagnosed as schizophrenia, that actually the alternative approaches say if you surround people with people who have an expectation of recovery, who are more inclusive, who are not threatened by the experience, who don't shun the person, who don't push them away, but actually build connection and relationship, then the outcome is very different. That the result is very, very different. The course of that illness, you could say, ends up being shaped by the social context and the beliefs that it's surrounded by.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and that would be similar to like what you would have if in another culture where people feel like what we would call schizophrenia would be the result of like spirit possession or something like that, and they wouldn't see it as the person's fault. They would see it as something that's just kind of part of this world. And so maybe the way they're treated then is different and more helpful or in some way, you know, whereas when you treat it like somebody is broken or they have some sort of physical biochemical defect, then it becomes harder for the person to envision like a path going forward in some way.
How do we get beyond the idea that this is dismissive? How do we get beyond the idea that, oh, this is just your beliefs, then it's just your culture, you just have to kind of rise above it, that it's something that's in your head? How do we move beyond that way of receiving what it is that you're presenting?
That's a good question. You know, it's really hard because, you know, our culture really is like a biomedical culture. And so the default interpretation, and, you know, I'm not saying that there's no biology involved here, but what you believe about that affects your experience of it, you know. And I think maybe one useful way to look at it, or a useful window into, is do the like placebo and nocebo research, where you can kind of see the mechanisms at work. You know, we know, especially in placebo pain, we're getting to get a pretty good understanding of just how these things actually function and how the expectation of pain can cause like actual measure, you know, pain that is not just imagined, but, you know, that is dealing with the opiate system. On the same note, the expectation of pain relief actually activates the opiate system in ways that your body releases actual painkillers that can be reversed by the hidden administration of naloxone. So there is like a measurable physical effect of the beliefs. It's not just, and that's what I'm talking about, getting past this dualism between the real and the imagined, you know. And the placebo, nocebo is the opposite of the placebo. It's like the placebo is experiencing the therapeutic results from the expectation of healing, and the nocebo is the opposite. Like if you give someone a drink and says this is going to make you vomit, and then it does, you know, and it's not like they really don't vomit, but the way those things interact is hard to understand or hard to interpret without revising kind of this simple dualism.
So part of it, I think, is this question of interpretation. Is interpretation just how you think of something? Is it just an idea, or is it actually also a physical, biological experience that's just as real, that's just as affecting you on a physical level? So it's not just about the belief being superimposed or being added, and then you can just change it. But beliefs and how we interpret things are very deeply embedded physiologically in our culture and in the ways that we live in our social traditions.
I mean, really, what we're talking about is what metaphor do we understand these things by? The typical metaphor that people use for health is a machine metaphor, like the car, body is like a car, you know, and you want to get better, you go to a doctor and he changes a part out. And I think that is fundamentally what needs to be revised. And I think as a model, I think this idea of a loop is maybe hopefully more useful than the idea of a machine that, you know, we repair. You know, and that machine metaphor applies also to the popularity of neuroscience, and it doesn't allow for the mind and the brain to be separate things.
So in a sense, what you're saying is that the biochemistry view, the idea of neuroscience and these kind of mechanistic understandings of chemicals in the body and neurotransmitters, this is also a story that we're telling ourselves in our culture.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not saying those are not really powerful and really important, but there's this other sort of complicating piece in there that needs to be built into the way we understand these things.
So what kinds of implications does that have for practicing medicine, or how do we proceed if we did take all this very seriously? Because one of the implications is that if we're always inside of stories, then there's really, we can start telling ourselves the story of the stories, but we're still creating a story. There's no place to step outside of it. There's no objective reality to step outside of.
A step in that direction in the DSM-5, they have in the back what's called a cultural formulation. It's like an interview that you can give to patients from other cultures, but that actually would be good for basically any patient, just to get an idea of what their understanding of their illness is. Like, what is the story of what Arthur Kleinman calls their illness narrative, and what do they feel like are the forces at work in there? And then based on that, maybe you can give them a helpful reframing that would push them in a direction that would be more helpful or more therapeutic or something. You know, so that would be a possibility.
Because the story that your car is broken makes a lot of sense, because you take it to the mechanic swaps out the alternator or the wheel or whatever it is, and then now your car starts working. But if we apply that to ourselves or to our minds or to our emotions, it doesn't work so well, because if we hand over the authority and the expertise to the medical profession, they don't always necessarily result in us getting healed. And so sometimes I think the important thing is to look at the stories that we're telling. Are we looking at broken parts that are going to be swapped out or fixed, or whether we need to start telling different stories that include our involvement in our own healing, our engagement, or look at things that are happening in our lives that might be playing a role in why it is that we're distressed or why it is that we've become ill, rather than just having this mechanical metaphor. So a lot of what you're saying, I think, supports the idea of stepping outside of one model of what illness is and then starting to think, well, what actually is serving the person? What would be a more meaningful story that could be told that actually is going to result in the person getting better or feeling more empowered or feeling clearer and stronger about their lives and healing and recovery? But then this raises the question about when we talk about beliefs, it sounds like, okay, a belief is just something you can change. Like, okay, I have a belief that this disease is caused by a fox spirit, and I can just change that belief. So now I believe that the disease is caused by a pathogen, and I can just change the belief. But I think what you're also suggesting is that belief is something much more profound, and that maybe it also works on a deeper unconscious and social level, that you can't just tell yourself, okay, I'm not going to believe in it, and then suddenly you'll feel better. It doesn't work that way. We're talking about a different understanding of what belief is.
You can't just decide to believe something. I mean, it's, you know, like if I thought there was some benefit to believing in being born again or something, I can't just tomorrow decide that I'm going to believe that if I don't really believe it. And so, there's a great novel by Pär Lagerkvist, who won the Nobel Prize, called Barabbas, where Barabbas, who, you know, was spared when Jesus was crucified, kind of follows these early Christians around and wants so badly to believe, but he just can't. It's a great like meditation on exactly this question. It becomes a little bit of a catch-22, doesn't it?
One of the studies that I read about the placebo effect is that if you tell somebody that they're receiving just a sugar pill, just a placebo, it can still have the beneficial effect, so that they might know on a more superficial conscious level that, okay, this is just a placebo, but somehow deep down, there's a more powerful belief that's at work that still activates the healing power of that placebo.
Yeah, I know the study you're talking about. And so they gave people a placebo, but in the script that they read to the patients, they said placebos have been known to help, blah, blah, blah. And so the operative thing here, I think, is the expectation. They're giving people a placebo. They know it's a placebo. It's labeled as a placebo, but they've also created the expectation that this will help you get better. Yeah, that's a lot of what's going on here, is the expectation of what people have for what is the powerful thing here that is going to cause events to happen in the future. And so what do you believe in at that level? And the expectation is really the most powerful pieces of the placebo effect. You know, do you expect this thing to help you heal? And when you do, it seems to activate these sort of endogenous healing processes that we have inside us.
Yeah, you said earlier that culture is really the belief about what forces are acting on us in the world and the stories that we tell about those forces and why things happen and what cause and effects are in reality. There's a cosmology around what makes reality happen. And you also mentioned just going to a healer, that if you go to someone who's presenting as a doctor, it kind of doesn't matter what it is that they are giving you in terms of a therapy, treatment, intervention. Just the very act of receiving the treatment from that person who's in the healer role has that powerful expectation.
Yeah, and that's come through in some interesting research by Ted Kopchak and those guys at Harvard, where they do a kind of placebo pain study on people, comparing acupuncture and sham acupuncture and placebo pills. The one that I'm thinking of, the sham acupuncture and the real acupuncture, had a very similar effectiveness in reducing pain, whereas the placebo pill had, it had some effect, but not as much. And so the theory is that this sort of elaborate ritual that you go through in acupuncture kind of helps stimulate these processes, which, you know, makes a lot of sense if you look at sort of history and ritual and how people had to kind of survive pre-hospitals. One of the things that people get upset about is, like I said, that you're questioning the reality of their illness. And I think there's a power in like naming your illness that's kind of a narrative power. Like, it means that everyone in society agrees that this is the causal chain of events you are part of. Like we were saying with everything with culture, you know, if everybody believes in a certain story, that means that it's real. So that's, I think, where some of the power of naming illnesses comes from.
People are suffering from something very isolated, very individual. They're questioning themselves whether it's real or not. Am I really in pain? Am I not? The people around them are questioning, well, maybe you can work, maybe you can go to school. Why is it that you're not participating? Why are you complaining? And then there's a certain naming that happens that gives legitimacy and gives support and value for what the person is going through. And so that has this enormous power of validating someone's experience. But then the other side of it is that it also can create a situation where the person goes into that identity and they start to step into that thinking of themselves in a certain way. And the story can be confining. It can be something that limits them or that puts them in a certain kind of a cultural box. Because I think that what is one of the interesting implications about what you're saying is that, you know, cultures change, and especially in a society that's multicultural, and especially when we're talking about something like the DSM and something like mental illness diagnosis as a huge cultural force, but at the same time is contested. So what we're really looking at is, what is the role of human freedom in shaping our experience? How is it that the choices that we make and the kind of beliefs that we hold, how does that actually affect and shape who we are and the kinds of illnesses that we fall prey to and the kinds of lives that we live? I mean, that's, I think, the deeper question that gets raised by some of the things that you're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that hasn't come up yet, but that's exactly what's at kind of the core of this discussion, is the idea of free will, you know, and do we have some free will in these matters? And I'm basically making the argument that we do, you know, not as completely as people used to think. The pendulum swung way toward the mechanistic idea of things, this idea that we're just sort of this chain of biochemistry that's ongoing, and there's no room in there for like a person to influence the processes, whereas I'm trying to make the argument that we do actually have some role in these things and some influence over these things. Yeah, Michael Gazzaniga has come up with, or not, maybe not come up with, but he argues for a different interpretation of the mind versus the brain. In a lot of neuroscience, there's this belief that the brain is real and the mind is sort of just a product of the brain, and you can, you know, by understanding all the things that are going on in the brain, you can understand the person and the mind. Gazzaniga has this idea of, you're familiar with the idea of emergence, how complex systems emerge from simple repeating things like the way one ant is stupid, but an ant colony develops a kind of intelligence once it reaches a certain critical mass. One interpretation of that is called weak emergence, where you should be able to look at the ant and figure out how the weak colony behaves. So there's a direct causal line between the small part and the big thing that comes out of it. Whereas the idea of strong emergence is that at some point in that process, it tips over into a different rules that don't apply to the individual parts, but that work for the whole system, you know. And so that would say that you can't really understand the colony by understanding the individual ant, because it's just a different set of rules. It's what he calls a phase shift, where in the same way that quantum physics obeys different rules than Newtonian physics. You know, at some point it crosses over and you just have to use a different set of rules. And so he argues for interpretation like that of the mind versus the brain, where at some point you have this point of strong emergence where the mind becomes this other thing that's not, you know, necessarily understandable by the parts of it. And that thing that emerges from the parts can act back on the physical brain that it came out of. And so so that's, you know, an interpretation that where you do have some will and some free will involved, you know, in the process, where the mind can actually influence the brain and the body. And that's, you know, I think what a lot of things are finding, you know, this kind of that idea is coming from different places. One of them is Richard Davidson and his research into how meditation can, you know, affect your gene expression, you know, things like that are becoming ways of saying the same thing, or, you know, that would fit into this kind of looping model where the mind and the brain are influencing each other, rather than just the brain is like causing the mind to do everything.
That's what's so intriguing about creating a distinction between the mind and the brain, is that if we just see things in terms of the brain, then there's kind of like this biological causality that everything is reduced to physical processes. But if we have something distinct called the mind, now the mind can actually influence and shape physical processes that we know from more and more from these studies. And then that starts to create more of an opening for free will rather than a biological determinism to become supported by understandings of what the mind is all about.
And I think that's a better space to be in. And, you know, then the question becomes figuring out what the limits of that free will are, you know, and what it can't do. And I think that would be the direction I would love to see things going in. You know, what are the limits of people's understandings of themselves and their narratives? And, you know, where does that, can we find the point at which those things intersect?
And are there narratives and cultures that we can create that are better suited for free will and better suited for responding to diseases and illness? And what are the actual implications of one set of stories compared to another set of stories?
Yeah, I mean, you can almost see this in like Carol Dweck's work about children, and how if you tell them intelligence is like a fixed thing, or if you tell them it's a muscle, they'll have radically different outcomes in their testing and their achievements, you know. And so that's another way of maybe looking at this, you know, by telling someone they do have free will, you have more of it. If you believe you have more of it, you have more of it. If you don't, you have less. And so that's another like kind of catch-22 that's built into this
Exactly. So the expectation that we can use our minds to influence our bodies itself creates the possibility that we can use our minds to influence our bodies. And it seems like it's very tied to fear. If you're really going to embrace a more fluid and a more open view where there are possibilities for making change, then you have to maybe step back away from that fear, because the determinism is so closely related to control, and being able to see outcomes is so closely related to the fear of something that might be unknown or outside of control. So it seems like there's some connection here between fear and free will and what stories we tell about how changeable our reality is.
Yeah, and it's also important to recognize that it's not infinitely changeable, but it is probably more changeable than you think it is.
So Frank, your book recently came out, The Geography of Madness, Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. Has it been controversial? What kinds of response have you gotten?
Yeah, it's been a little controversial. I mean, people get upset when you tell them that something that they've experienced is culturally related. And I think that's a little bit of a misinterpretation, because it's just because something is culturally related doesn't mean it's not real, or doesn't mean that they should have total control over it, or sad. I'm saying something else, that in the same way that a Nigerian would be upset if you told them that, if you just came up and said, you know, this isn't, penis stealing is not real. It's not, I don't think, a useful way to look at this stuff. These ideas are coming from a lot of different places at the same time, and there hasn't really been a model that can accommodate this kind of more nuanced way of seeing the self and our health and stuff. And so it's been welcomed in a lot of ways, that the idea that we do have some free will in these affairs.
Do you think there are implications for how we think about mental illness or how we think about disease and disorders?
I think it'd be good to get away from thinking of these things as purely biomechanical issues, you know, because that has been, that has really produced not much in the way of progress or research and treatment. You know, that if you look at the results that people are getting, they're not getting better. The treatment results are not getting better. And so in the National Institute of Mental Health is not really interested in funding anything other than looking for like biomarkers for these things. And I think it could be useful. It could also be a huge waste of money. And then the other things should be looked at as well, you know, and how people's self-concept and narratives affect their levels of mental health. And so, you know, if you could broaden the number of tools that people have to try to get better, I think that would be nothing but a good thing.
And one of the things that you mention in the book is that, and this is very important research, I think, for all of us to understand, is that there are all these different kinds of psychological theories and psychological therapies out there, and it turns out that they all work pretty much the same in terms of the effectiveness.
Yeah. As far as psychotherapy, yes. It's, people don't really like that finding, because everybody has their own different, you know, kinds of psychotherapies, but it's been found several times that they all do work, and they all work, you know, similarly well.
And that's consistent with the perspective that you're taking on culture and self narrative and stories.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's that's my understanding of it, is that there's a power in kind of looking at your own story and your own self and kind of reconsidering it and looking at who you think you are and where you think your life is going. And that's, you know, I think always going to be a factor in these things.
Frank, we're just about out of time. Remind us the name of your book, and also give us your website and how people can get in touch with you if they want to find out more information.
My website is just frankburrus.com, and there's all kinds of information about the book on there. And the book is called The Geography of Madness, Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for the Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. And you should be able to get it at your local bookstore. That's the best place.
Frank Burrus, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Frank Burrus. He is a writer based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. His stories have been in the Best American Travel Writing Anthology, and he's the author of the new book, The Geography of Madness, Penis Thieves, Voodoo Death, and the Search for the Meaning of the World's Strangest Syndromes. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.